The Isle of the Serpent, a three-part recording, part two, 33 minutes.
Great. So this is an ancient Egyptian scripture. It's from the time of the pyramids and the pharaohs and all of that. And I was interested to read what Egyptologists were saying about this, saying this is a very puzzling story. It's very hard to understand what it means. And it was just very confusing. People can't agree on it. And so we're in the position of trying to interpret something that the community of scholars do not feel they understand. Which is kind of an interesting place to be in. I wonder if people want to suggest what they think this story is about. What did you make of it? How do you understand it? If you think of it as a dream or as a symbolic tale, does anybody want to suggest what it's about?
Yeah, the count failed where the attendant succeeded. The count came back with his men. His ego was intact, where the attendant lost everything.
Okay.
And when he lost the outer encasing of his perception of the world, he came to the unconscious. The island was in the water. He was swept by the wave. And I think what the serpent was his unconscious. And Nick was clever enough to understand he failed. He, you know, came back with his men, and he knows he's going to be killed in some manner because he didn't pass the test that the attending passed.
Do other people have comments?
Presumably that these were all hieroglyphics that were translated.
I think so, yes.
Do you know the history of that war happening? Did it?
I don't know when it was first translated, no. But it's a famous old... There's not so many of these. This is rather unusual, but it's very... been very well studied.
Where actually was it sounded parallel to the biblical narrative.
Can you speak?
To me, there's a parallel to the biblical narratives. I reacted to the fact that the author always presents exact measures or exact distances or exact times. And it reminded me of the biblical story of when the Ark of the Covenant was to be placed in a holy, it would be a synagogue now in modern language, and the exact dimensions are gone into great detail. Mm-hmm. Something should be so far exact. So mm-hmm. I was reacting to the exactness mm-hmm. of the thing. And another parallel to a biblical story is it's a morality play, a story that's designed to teach something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure exactly what it was teaching, but my reaction to it was, it was teaching me something.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the person is on his or her belly. I was saying his, but her belly. The person is on her belly, and the serpent is rising up.
Mm-hmm.
Just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Where the serpent is with the way the person is with him. Mm-hmm. So, just a marvelous story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to interpret it. I just mm-hmm. sort of enjoyed it as, mm-hmm. as a story.
Mm-hmm.
One aside, they say everything is on the island. If it was a woman, you know, presumably it was a man, because it was all, you know, where were the women on the island? I think this is just a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts about meaning? Interpreting?
No.
Yeah.
I have kind of, I mean, your perception of about the unconscious is, I think that's probably something, but we need to go. But before, we like to understand the facts, the facts that the story gives us.
Uh-huh.
And I think that there was someone that succeeded in something, someone that failed. And there is definitely a moral here, a learning from this story. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there are a lot of subconscious concepts in there. But I, by reading the story, it sounds like the return, I mean, just the facts, some facts.
Mm-hmm.
The return safe, we should be praying, that's what the attendant sends mm-hmm. to account. We're alive and we are praising to the God.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, and I'm trying to please you. Mm-hmm. Or I, that's what the attendant seems to be doing,
mm-hmm.
saying, we are, I mean, I have a similar story that in a way I failed, but I succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you use your mouth when you present, that reminds me when I have to speak to my boss. what you say, the way you say it, will save you.
Yes.
So the guy, the tenant, tells the story of the serpent, and then once he apparently, no, tell the story. They're not that bad. We will be fine. You're going to present this to the king. Say, hey, don't be arrogant.
Yeah.
And when and what I understand from you, someone don't feed a bird the day before the bird is going to die. Don't spend time with me because I'm going to be punished tomorrow or something mm-hmm. is going to happen to me. So, those, no, some facts, and then we can, you know,
mm-hmm.
talk about what the serpent is, how this mm-hmm. plays into the story, but those are, you know, just the, mm-hmm. some foundations.
Mm-hmm. Any more thoughts about this?
It felt like it repeated, and I missed the transition when it repeated. I'm like, okay, it's repeating.
Yeah, the Hungarian reading?
I missed something in there. You know, kind of, and I'm like, okay, repeating the story, but now we're adding figs and stuff to it. Okay, it was like a richer.
Okay, uh-huh. Yeah.
So
yeah,
I was like, a little literalist, you know. And I'm like, okay. It's a double story.
Uh-huh.
But it's not, it's slightly different.
Uh-huh.
Like you went back and revised it.
So you're picking up on the storytelling dimension.
The story, well, the dimension of, like, you know, when you tell the story and then when you're in the retelling, and you remember, oh, and the fig, you know how, like,
yeah.
your memory kind
yeah.
of recalls things over
yeah.
time, or as you're telling you, oh, I forgot to add that piece. It felt like it got richer the second
yes.
time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The serpent was extremely intelligent,
yeah.
as the unconscious is, but I think in Greek mythology, the serpent was like a god, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, it looking through the Jungian lens, who knows if the creators of the story, maybe the whole perception is skewed not in a way, but there seems to be a parallel between the wisdom of the unconscious and the Egyptian god,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. like Thoth, or, you know, whatever it is.
And also, when you're by rivers, there's lots of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
So Egypt has the big river with lots of snakes
yes,
living
yes.
in the river and near it.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
There's symbolism of that.
Okay, so now let's go through it and talk about it as we go through. Let's look at the pieces. Several people noted talking about speech. Listen to me, Ken, I'm an over-talkative. Then will you answer when you're addressed and speak to the king with presence of mind? You will answer without hesitation. A men's mouth saves him. His speech obtains indulgence for him. But do as you wish. Talking to you thus wearies you. I will relate to you there then something similar. There's a great deal in that first beginning about talking and speech and telling stories. A big emphasis on storytelling. So,
and the theme of speak now.
Yes.
Don't delay. Don't stop to think.
Yeah.
It's repeated when the mm-hmm. sailor has to confront the serpent in the
yes.
foreign country.
Yes, it's repeated again that the serpent insists that the sailor must tell his story. In fact, the serpent demands it seven times, if you count. and threatens that punishment. He's going to be incinerated and sent up in smoke if he doesn't. So the serpent is absolutely insistent that the sailor must tell his story. And so indeed the sailor's story gets told at least twice. And then what does the serpent do?
He carries him off in his mouth. Then he rewards
the sailor.
He what?
He rewards the sailor by taking him somewhere.
But you're missing something. What does the serpent do before that?
He carries him off in his mouth.
And?
Take him to a resting place.
And?
Oh, he tells him his story. He
tells him his story. And the serpent tells him his story.
Okay.
Right? Mm. So that's that repetition again. Story. This is about storytelling.
The serpent story was very confusing. I couldn't understand it, but that's all of you. Did you have insight into that?
Well,
the 49 cousins were killed.
Well, yeah. Let's get to that in a little while. We'll come back to that. Yes. So again, this huge emphasis on storytelling. So let's think about storytelling. What is it to tell a story? What are you doing when you tell a fairy story, for example, or a ghost story, or a frightening story, or an exciting story?
Life story. You're giving, I always find, it's an illustrative example of a point you're trying to make. So it illustrates, makes the point, on some level draws an analogy with the common bond that you're experiencing with the person you're telling the story
mm-hmm.
to.
But these are not very pragmatic stories. These are kind of weird and wonderful.
Weird stories, right.
Weird and wonderful stories. So what is it to tell weird and wonderful stories?
Are you making conscious what's archetypal and unconscious in nature?
Yes. To tell a story is an artistic act, right? It's like creating a poem or creating a painting. You're going down into the unconscious realm, finding images there and bringing them out in bringing out these images as symbols, putting together to create a fairy story, right? A magical story. So it's a process of delving into the unconscious and bringing it up into consciousness and communicating. That's what storytelling does. It's like dreaming does that too. You dream and then you relate your dream. You go into the unconscious and you sleep, and then you bring it into consciousness by relating it and sharing it.
Mm.
Storytelling is like that. Because when you tell stories, you are inspired creatively by the unconscious to come up with the images.
There was a radio personality for many years. I think his name was Gene Shepherd, something. But he had a radio show that would go on most of the night. It was nationwide. And you could listen, you'd be on like from 11 or 12 at night to 4 in the morning, and he would talk stories all night
mm-hmm.
long.
Mm-hmm.
And they were largely vignettes of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd become entranced by those things, listening to these things. Nothing complex, but just a story of life. And you'd enter into it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's think about this for a moment. What just described this process of going down to the unconscious and bringing it back is a repetition of that idea in this story.
Yes.
And what is it?
Thrown in the ocean and surviving.
Yeah. And coming back home. Yeah. Yeah. And what else besides being thrown into the ocean? He didn't exactly eat him. He just carried him in his mouth.
Yeah.
Held him.
Yeah, if you don't like serpents.
Notice he was very very gentle.
Very gentle serpent.
And very friendly, actually.
And intelligent.
Yeah. Smart serpent.
But as you pointed out, the serpent seems to represent the other side of, you know, represents the unconscious
mm-hmm.
realm. So the whole story of going to the land of the serpent and coming back is a journey into the unconscious and out again. So the storytelling is that, and the story is that. So there's that, again, that repetition of ideas. And what does he bring back from the land of Punt?
Wealth beyond the wealth to make him like a sovereign himself. You know?
Yeah, but let's be more specific. Everything in the image, everything in the story has meaning. What exactly does he bring back? What are the
myrrh and love?
Myrrh. incense,
eggs.
Think about the things that he brings back. Does he bring back iron ore or gold?
Put back. The most of the cases are the things that he was going to offer as a reward to the serpent for saving him.
He was going to get into the serpent, and the serpent says,
yeah, yeah, have it all.
Do we have it? You ain't got nothing. What kinds of things are these that are being traded here?
Evocative.
Evocative, yeah. What do you think about that word evocative?
They evoke physical senses when you're with myrrh or incense. You transport not in, of the body.
Physical senses?
Well, I think of incense and myrrh as oil, as unguent.
Perfumes.
Where might you be encounter in Western storytelling?
Jesus.
Yeah, in religious occasions, right? Mm-hmm. These might be used for religious rituals.
These were the three wise men.
It's got a spiritual sense down there too, right? You burn incense, you chant, you listen to Eastern music, and you know, it's aromatherapy. Yeah, it's about spirituality. So these things are evocative, and giraffe tails and the other things, they would all have symbolic and spiritual meaning. So again, we have the idea of things which evoke from the unconscious, or evoke, you know, deeper meanings or higher meanings, or, you know, evoke something more than just the practical.
The relationship between evoke and vocalize.
Evoke, okay. Yes, they speak. They speak in a spiritual language, you could say, or in a sensory language which evokes a different state of mind. Okay. All right, so... So we have this idea again and again of going into the unconscious and bringing it back, or evoking. Now, what about this? I went down to the ship, to the sea, in a ship of 120 cubits of length, 40 cubits in width. This is what you were alluding to. 120 sailors, the best in Egypt. Well, they looked at the sky, where they looked at the land, their hats were startled in lines. They foretold a storm before it had come, and foul weather before it had arisen.
Even the mighty must bow their head to access God. Because it's funny because those sailors seem stronger than the count's sailors, yet he was able to sacrifice them.
Well, wait, just don't jump too fast. What do we got with all these numbers and these steps things?
Facts.
What's that?
Facts.
Facts. Yes, facts. Measurable, rational. Right brain facts. And stout sailors?
Strong.
Strong. Strong what?
Brave.
Brave. Strong.
Solid. Earthy.
Yeah.
Lions.
Lions. But what is strong here?
Ego.
Ego, yeah. Because these are the sailors who can look at the sky and foretell the weather. They can look at the land and their hearts were stout. See, we know exactly how long the ship is, we know exactly how wet it is, we know exactly how many sitters, we can foretell the weather.
Do we still die?
We got to give consciousness is in charge.
I read that I was reacting that there was a book by Norman Mailer called The Young Lions. But the same notion that they were gods themselves, mere gods themselves.
Well, they're lions of technological power. I mean, sailing is a conscious technology, right? You build a ship, you have a compass or whatever, and you have a rudder, and you make the ship go where you want to go. You go voyaging, and you trade, and, you know, it's all about mastery of the world.
But it's very high risk.
Well, what happened? Well, we just heard, yeah, it's high risk, we just heard about how stuck they are, and then what happens to them?
They all die.
They're all wiped out.
So much for stuff.
So what's the message here? What is this story? What is this story showing?
That the meek shall inherit the earth.
Oh, you're still with the image. That's not what the image is saying. Stay with the image.
Well, you can't inherit the earth. You can't meet God by with the strength of Him. That you have to bow.
Okay.
That's what I meant by meek. Okay. The strength does not help.
Okay.
The humbleness.
But wait a second. The reason I'm doing that is there's nothing said here about meekness at this point. I'm just asking you.
Yeah, I'm trying to show.
Not that you're wrong, but just staying with the image at the moment. It doesn't mention, what I just described doesn't mention meekness. So I'm just trying to hold with what we got right in front of us in the moment. Mm-hmm. It does come up later. But I'm trying to be precise as we interpret a dream to stay with us.
I don't know, but for me it's like, even if you have a very strong ego or you act like very, your conscious part is in charge of it, when the unconscious part wants to appear, it doesn't matter.
Yes, yeah. Okay. See, I think that the details are a bit overdetermined. I mean, we can get more information than we really need as to exactly how many cubits long. And exactly. It's the ego anxiously insisting, you know, I know what's going on. I know how long the ship is. I know how many sailors. They're good sailors. We're going to be fine. We're all under control. So it's overly exaggerated consciousness, which, you know, that's a modern phenomenon too, right? We still suffer from an overly... you know, we have life insurance, we have automobile insurance, we have fire insurance, you know. We're totally insured against acts of God, so nothing's going to happen.
I have many consultants saying, I have everything I need in the presentation. I have the facts, I have my backup, I have the best computer, I have the multimedia. And they came with this question.
Yeah, right. So the ego is not adequate for this journey. It's weaker than we think.
Well, they sailed outside. It seemed like there was a perimeter. They sailed past the last known island in the Egyptian coordinate system. So the last consciously cognitive island. The first guy, the attendant. And so when he ventures beyond that, beyond the conscious realm, that stuff seems of little value.
Yes, yes. And of course, in those days, the ships were not very seaworthy. So, you know, if you didn't really hug the shoreline, you were in great danger. They were not very ships.
They
were.
You not only depend on the wind that they have. That's why the sailors were so important and their strength. So
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think ships try to land. They try to navigate around the shore. They could, when they had to venture into the Mediterranean, they had to do that. It was at great risk. The weather had better stay good. So yeah. Okay. So then, let's see what happens next. Everybody's wiped out except me, and then I lay within a shelter of wood and I clung to the shade for 3 days alone. So he's so shocked and frightened by the complete defeat of his conscious adaptation that he stays in shock for 3 days and can't even move. But then his hunger gets the best of him because I got to my feet to know what I could put in my mouth. So he's driven by instinctual, not by rationality, not by plans. He's no longer, you know, making measurements and planning. He's just starving. So he's driven by his belly. And lo and behold, he's richly fed. Okay, so what are we finding here?
Well, Jung talks a lot about the internal goal. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the real thing is the inner goal is the most important. So he's in this unconscious realm, and that's where the wealth is. Even when they're going back, you know, you don't need that. It's he talks about the source of wealth being there, fed.
Yeah. So he thought that it was in a ship. He thought a ship was so great. He loses all that, and then to his surprise, the Lord will provide. He gets very well provided for by this other realm. Yes, and it's very rich. And sure enough, he makes a burnt offering to the gods, so he's got a respectful attitude. And under his noise, I felt sure a wave of the sea. The trees were splitting. The earth was shaking. When I uncovered my face, I found that it was a serpent. 30 cubits long. His beard was more than two cubits long. His beard was plated with gold. His eyebrows were real lapis lazuli. He was extremely intelligent. So, is this a repetition?
Yeah, but he feels like he's fed and like everything is civilizing again. Now he's back again to his unconsciousness and facing again death. I feel like he's facing like the serpent, like he's very afraid of the serpent.
Yes, so he's in the face of overwhelming force,
yes.
Right?
Again.
And he's very afraid. And again, it completely transcends rational understanding. This is an irrational beast.
But even though he's measuring it and describing it as
a... Yeah, but he's describing a mysterious... like describing a dragon, you know, it's got 4 feet and it's coming out of its mouth, but it's still beyond comprehension.
And it's more like a machine with a spirit inside. I mean, if it's, you know, made out of gold and lapis lazuli, then it's not made out of flesh or...
Right.
Or bone, or anything like that. It's more like a machine. It's a mass.
It's definitely not natural.
To me, the image was like if you could see Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where there's this awesome thunder.
Okay.
Mysterious thing that appears out of. So it's like an archetypical image.
Yes, a very, very wonderful, mysterious thing. Now, it's extremely intelligent.
And old. He had a long beard. Could it be he broke through, because he had riches before the snake, so he was fed by the personal unconscious. Could it be that he broke through to a more universal unconscious, as typified by the snake, more of a
arc? But see, that's interesting. But see, the food that he was given was not his personal possession. It was the food of the forest or of the fields. So it's not personal, it's all impersonal.
Well, not consciously possessed by him, but maybe unconsciously he possessed it, right? It could be.
Yeah, it's
not. It could be mind, but it's mind, so it's not until you get that level. It just seems like he's breaking through a different kind of level when the snake comes.
Well, I guess you're right. I mean, the food that he gets is wonderful, but it's not mysterious. It's the kind of food that he probably had before on good days when he was well fed. But it's kind of wonderful that there's so much of it. I mean, it's like the Horn of Plenty. It actually does have a kind of a mysterious... The abundance is mysterious. So, but it's not as... I would agree that it's taken to another level of mystery. Deeper mystery.
A godlike
level. Yeah, yeah. But the food is like not from heaven, too. It's
because the way that he described the serpent and the food is like when he describes the food, he didn't talk so much about the facts. It says cucumbers and toucans, but when he describes the serpent, that it's more mysterious, it's like he gives more facts. It's 2 cubits long, it's 30 cubits long, and it has gold, real lapis lazuli. It's like he describes more like from more rational way, like more he needs to put it more in intensive language that
right.
The other thing that is more easy to understand than cucumbers
or maybe things that are more familiar. He's describing vegetables, cucumbers, fish and fowl.
And there's no danger in that, but there's danger
right.
in the snake that as he progresses, there's more reward, there's more danger too.
Well, you really have to describe this thing because otherwise how would anybody know what it's like?
Yeah.
You know, nobody's seen this before.
Yeah.
The thing is that the food, it covers the basic needs. You know, he needs to survive when he is in a shipwreck, finds an island, he needs to find food.
That's true.
That's the first thing that, you know, basic needs, survival. And then it sounds like this serpent comes to support or provide to satisfy different needs.
Something deeper.
At the higher level, as she was saying.
That makes sense. Yeah, I do keep thinking that the food is also symbolic in meaning. It's not just real food, it's also spiritual food,
okay.
I think. And it's almost like it prepares them for the next level of food that's going to come to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he has to bow in his belly and he has to go through another ritual relinquishing of whatever ego's left. He already, the sailors are going to be, he has to still go in his belly and pray or whatever.
But what do we make of this idea that he's extremely intelligent?
He was saying about the subconscious, the power of the subconscious, intelligence, of knowledge of the subconscious has, and we don't understand.
Yes, it's like dreams seem to be exquisitely designed to tell us what we're ready to know. Mm. It's from a mysterious unconscious on the other side. And there's another image in this that supports that idea of consciousness within the unconscious. And what is that other image? It's a repetition of that idea. Well, let me not take time, but just it's the whole island. The island that he's discovered is above water. It's not underwater, it's above water. So it's consciousness, but it's an island of consciousness in the unconscious, which is rich with all of these wonderful treasures. So that, again, is the idea of this extreme intelligence within the unconscious.
A place where, you know, and it's funny because you think in your fantasies, okay, yeah, I can just kind of meditate, just rest there. Yeah. It's a place that, you know, just like going to the desert island, and all the stuff's available.
But in fact, he doesn't rest. And there's a lot that goes on here.
No, I was talking about my fantasy.
Okay. So now the serpent insists, as I say, 7 times, tell me how you got here. You must tell me, you must tell me, you must tell me, you must tell me. If you don't tell me, I'm going to burn you up. What's this?
Well, he's trying to get him to recognize that this process, I think.
What process?
The process of finding plenty, or finding the understanding, finding the unconsciousness and valuing it, as opposed to the...
Be more specific, let's be...
Here, one of the students argued several times that the serpent was evil and destructive because it was threatening to eat the sailor.
There's no indication of that. That's something you're imposing. Nothing that says the serpent is... But it doesn't hurt him. See, that's a projection. The serpent is completely benign. This guy's completely benign. We're used to thinking of this.
Well, the serpent got evil in Christian mythology.
Yeah, in this story, the serpent is not... But stay with the image. The serpent insists, you must tell me your story. And then as soon as he does, the serpent... tells his story.
You know, I was at a class couple years ago.
No, wait, I want to answer this question. What is the story getting at here? What is it insisting upon?
He wants the truth. He thinks that if the guy speaks without thinking, that what he says is more likely to be the truth.
He doesn't. That's not a. There's no conversation here about truth. It just says, "Tell me your story."
This is the end of part 2. The discussion continues in part 3. Thank you.